Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. I'm Daniel Henry Price, and I am joined by Chad Bird. Chad, we are 4 weeks away from doing this thing live.
4 weeks, that's all?
That's it, man. 4 weeks.
Wow. Time is rolling on. I wish I could say I'm ready, but I still have some preparation to do.
I do, too. I was actually starting to think about that. As I'm talking up the conference, getting people pumped, I realized, oh yeah, I'm supposed to do some stuff at this thing. I should.
Right, yeah.
That's how I roll. Like, wait till. Yeah.
I got a couple early bird devotions that are so far unwritten, but I've got it's in my head. It's in my head. Let's put it that way. Just gotta get it down on paper. That's the problem.
That's what they make plane rides for.
There you go. Okay. Layovers. Yeah. Early mornings. We'll be good to go by then.
Yeah. Don't worry. Don't do what me and Chad do with your with preparing the things to say at the conference. Don't do that in relation to you getting your tickets to the conference. You should do that ahead of time. You have 4 weeks, so you should definitely think about joining. Especially if you live out in California. You gotta come. It's insane if you don't come, because everything you're gonna get, everyone's gonna be there. We want to see you. It's gonna be the best time that you've ever had. So you should come out. It's herewestillstand.org for all the details. If you want to get 10% off that ticket price, which is already insanely low, you can type in 40OT in the checkout box and you'll get 10% off. We would definitely love to see you there. So we're going to be doing one of these podcasts, episode 100, live from the event. So come be in the audience and hang out with us. Chad, speaking of the Old Testament, where are we at in it?
We left off in the middle of Exodus 28. So that's where we'll pick up today. We've been talking about clothing, of all things. The fancy word is vestments, the fancy sacred clothing that the priest wore. So that's what we started talking about last time, maybe a little ways into the chapter, but we need to pick it up from there. And then we'll jump into chapter 29 after that, which is all about, so first of all, we're talking about what the priest wear. That's basically all of chapter 28. And then chapter 29 is about the consecration, the ordination of Aaron and his sons. So that's what's coming up next. We introduced all of these various vestments. If you listen to the last episode, you realize there's a ton of stuff that Aaron has to put on, especially. They start with these linen underwear, these shorts that they wear, but then they got a robe that goes over that. They have this thing called an ephod. There's a breast piece on the ephod. They have hats that they wear. The high priest has a headband that he wears. So you got, basically, he's covered, I would say, from head to toe, but as I pointed out last time, his toes are not covered because he doesn't wear any shoes. The priest always minister at the tabernacle barefoot because they're on sacred ground. So at least from ankle up, they are covered in various articles of clothing, which set them apart. Literally, they sanctifies them and make sure that everybody who sees them knows that these guys are the priests and that guy is the high priest. The ephod, which is like a vest. Other stories in the Old Testament, you'll hear about ephods, and evidently there were lots. Maybe this was kind of like a umbrella word for all different sorts of sacred type things, because there's some evidence of ephods that actually stand upright, almost like a statue of sorts. This ephod is like a vest. It's the best way I can describe it. And when we stopped last time, we were talking about how on the shoulder pieces of the vest, there are two precious stones that have the names of six of the tribes in one stone and the other six tribes on the other stone. So those are on the shoulder piece. And then on what's called the breast piece, it's a square pouch-like object that goes right over the heart. That is That also has 12 precious stones on it, one for each of the 12 tribes of Israel. So when we wrapped up last time, I was making the point that the beauty of this is that any time this one man, this high priest, stepped before God in the holy place to offer up prayers, or on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, when he went into the Holy of Holies to sprinkle the blood on the Ark of the Covenant. When he did that, it wasn't just Aaron doing it, or it wasn't just Eleazar, or whoever the high priest happened to be. He was the embodiment of all of Israel. So wherever the high priest went to serve, all of Israel went with him. And that was the purpose of the names of the Israelites being carried over the heart and on the shoulders of the high priest. And then, of course, I related that to the work of Christ, to our high priest, who doesn't wear any kind of jewelry, but instead he wears our own flesh and blood, our humanity. So God become man, steps before the throne of the Father with all of humanity in him, so that where he is, there we are. And just as the Father loves and accepts him, he loves and accepts us. So that's the fulfillment. That's what these precious stones that the high priest wore are pointing forward to. And it's a great example of how this chapter is really all about Christ. It's about vestments, yeah, it's about sacred clothing, but all of this is pointing beyond itself to its completion in the work of Christ, in the person of Christ, in its own humanity. That's what all of this, in one way or another, is leading us toward, is the priestly work of Christ. So anyway, that's kind of a summary of where we were at last time, and a little bit of a recap there of what we talked about last. Now, there's one verse here that's kind of interesting. We'll talk about it for a second, and you may or may not have heard of this, but inside this breast piece that I've been talking about, the ones that has the 12 stones on it, there's a couple of items placed. They're called the Urim and Tumim, or you might, this is pronounced different ways, the Urim and Thummim or something like that. But in Hebrew, it's the Urim and the Tumim. And it says that they shall be placed inside, it's like a pouch, so placed inside this pouch-like breast piece. And they're going to be over Aaron's heart when he goes in before the Lord. Well, what in the world are these? Well, we're told about these in a few different places in the rest of the Old Testament. Nothing is really elaborated here. It's almost like it's like they're just thrown out there. Like you already know about these. Like this is something that has already been in existence, or at least something like this has already been in existence. The words themselves are, I mean, they're not translated, right? It's what we call transliteration, where we just basically spell out the Hebrew word. So the Urim and Thummim, there's all kinds of scholarly debates as to exactly how you might translate these, but I don't think most translations even translate them. They just put the two Hebrew words there. Best way we can figure out is that these were some sort of maybe dice-like objects, and one meant yes, and one meant no, basically. And the way these were used was, if there was a decision that needed to be made where the Lord's will needed to be known, and it was something where God had not actually made his will known. Or that maybe were they supposed to go to battle? Were they supposed to do this? Were they supposed to do that? Well, they don't have any kind of biblical word that says, yes, do this, or no, don't do that. So it's up in the air. It's a decision that has to be made, and they want to seek what the Lord's will is. What they're going to do is basically kind of put it as a A or B, or a yes or no kind of question, because that's two options. And I don't know if they rolled these stones. We really don't know if they reached in and grabbed one. We don't know how they did it, but that's how the decision was made. So basically, this is a way in which you could figure out what God's will was. I should back up. This is the way, especially leaders, this wasn't just for anybody. You know, you couldn't go in farmers couldn't go in and say, hey, I can't decide if I'm going to plant wheat or barley this year. Could you pull out the Urim and Thummim and tell me? This was like big decisions, national decisions, leaders' decisions where these were consulted. And this was then understood, whatever, if it was the Urim or if it was the Thummim, this was understood to be God's will for whatever that particular decision was. So you can think of it as a very sacred way of flipping a quarter, more or less, to decide which way to go. I think that's probably the way that Dan makes all his decisions at church. Isn't that right?
Yeah, we just draw straws.
Draw straws.
That's how we do it. Every decision. That's how the apostles did it, you know?
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, it is similar to casting lots. And the last, at least to my knowledge, the last time that happened in the Bible was in Acts chapter 1. They had to find a replacement for Judas Iscariot, right?
Yeah.
So they put, they didn't just say, you know, line up a whole bunch of people and say, which one? They narrowed it down and then to people, you know, that met certain criteria. And then they cast lots.
Yeah, that whole thing is weird to me. Like I mean, this that what you're talking about right now, and just the casting lots thing, it seems so it's so odd,
arbitrary.
I mean, obviously you have like this like super strong dependency and belief in the sovereignty of God if you're rolling like this, which of course I do. But it seems so. It's just a weird
I know thing. It's strange.
Yeah.
I was reading an article last week about this. I think it was on the Gospel Coalition. So I just Googled it to see what would come up with this. And anyway, the author said that he had been in a couple of churches where like some kind of leadership decision was made. Maybe it was deacons or elders or something like that. And they made the decision actually by casting lots.
Really?
I wasn't aware that this was still a practice in at least some churches, but
I'm actually of the opinion, and I don't know if this is controversial or not. So maybe
we don't really deal with controversy.
Yeah, maybe I should. I have some unpopular opinions that I know not to say. this one I'm not sure if this is okay or not, but I guess I'll just go for it. I am actually of the opinion that the apostles actually just got that totally wrong, that you know that Paul was the replacement for Judas, and here's the thing that Christ chooses his own apostles, and that they sort of jumped the gun on that sucker, and that Paul was the guy, because you never hear from this other guy ever again.
Yeah, that's true.
He never comes up again. Like, and I don't know.
Halfway through Acts, all you hear about is Paul. After that, right?
Yeah. And not that it means that this guy was like not a good guy or wasn't a believer or anything. I don't think that. I just don't think that's how God was going to do it. And I also just think that that's so human of us to be like, well, let's figure this out. We'll just draw some straws and cast some lots or whatever, and we'll do it that way.
Listen, we can't have 11 apostles. Yeah, it has to be 12.
Yeah, I mean, you got a bunch of Jewish guys. I mean, I'm sure they get the correlation, and they're like 12 tribes of Israel. Like, we got to have 12. Like, that's how it's going to go. And I think that, yeah, there is – I mean, like, that is what is going on when Jesus does that. But it's also like he's going to do it. You don't have to – I mean, if he wants 12, he'll make – and he does. I mean, like, he goes and knocks Paul off his horse. And the apostles, in my mind, are chosen – so monergistically by God himself, and Christ is the one that calls them all. And you see that happen with Paul. I mean, and we know that this is not just God, but like is Christ when he's like, Paul, why are you persecuting me? Right. Yeah. So I'm like, yeah, I think that that's, I don't think that we ended up with 12 and then 11 and then 13. I think it was 12 and then 11 and then God is man, and the apostles sort of jumped the gun and made someone an apostle who technically I don't think really ever was. Now, again, I don't know if that's controversial or not, but that's the opinion I have.
The emails will be pouring in, taking issue.
I don't even know if that's like I don't know if anyone else even has. To me, like, that's just what I think, and I've kind of always thought that. I might be the only person on Earth with that opinion, for all I know. Like, I have no idea. Do you share that opinion, Chad, or have you ever heard that opinion?
I have never actually heard that opinion, to be honest. No, and nor have I actually really dwelt on it that much. I figure all they're doing is basically following this kind of Old Testament precedent where, hey, they cast lots all the time in the Old Testament. So being good Jews, they thought, hey, let's just cast lots. We'll be back at 12 that way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I can roll either way with
Yeah,
it.
I don't think any doctrine's at stake here.
Yeah, I don't think any doctrine's at stake. One thing is for sure that the apostles certainly did jump the gun in many other situations. They were not perfect decision-making human beings. And secondly, yeah, Christ did get his apostle. If that was indeed jumping the gun, he got Paul, right?
Yeah.
And it's Paul that you hear about, well, basically for the whole rest of the New Testament. So
Yeah.
the least of the apostles who has the most apostolic material in the New Testament.
Right. Yeah. You're gonna be looking high and low for that book of Matthias or
Yeah, one of the lost epistles there.
whatever.
All right, so anyway,
That was a
back to
total bunny trail there, but it is interesting. I mean, like the lots thing is, yeah, you can't help but think of just like some old movie where there's some like lady being like, let's shake the let's put the bones in the cup and then like find out if we're gonna go to
right.
war or not, you know?
Pull it out, yeah. Well, it certainly wasn't as odd as many of the other ways of discerning what one should do in the ancient world. I mean, they did everything from reading arrows, like the flight of arrows, to the flight of birds, a main way of trying to divinize, to find out whatever God's will might be was through inspecting the livers or other organs of animals. I mean, there was all sorts of very, at least to us anyway, very strange ways of trying to figure out what God wanted you to do. So at least culturally speaking, in the broad perspective of the ancient world, casting lots is pretty tame.
Yeah.
And at least this was, I mean, this was these were sacred. They were like right over the heart of the high priest, hidden inside his sacred vestments. And so this was at least the way that you could know for sure what God wanted you to do. And in fact, we have instances of this being done in two or three Old Testament texts where they were consulted. Nothing after David, interestingly. The last occasion of this happens around the reign of David, nothing after that. I'm sure they were still around, but we don't have any stories of where they were actually used after
Yeah.
that.
And most of those
Plenty
things,
of
most of those other things that you're talking about, like most of this stuff is nowhere commanded. Like if you want to know what I think, check out a cow's liver. Like that, like God doesn't, a lot of this seems to be quite cultural, when you're talking about that
Yes,
stuff.
yeah.
Not as if God said, well, do this and you'll be able to know what I think, but I think culturally then that there was a lot of that kind of stuff, like trying to read the signs, right?
Yeah. And I suspect, I don't have the evidence for this, but I suspect sometimes that things like this were actually almost an accommodation to the situation that the Israelites were in. They had all these ancient peoples around them who had their own kind of weird ways of reading the signs. And so God's like, well, you know what? I'll give you a way to read the signs, one that is secure, that is sanctioned, that actually has my stamp of approval on it, and that is the Urim and Thummim. So anyway, that's a kind of a interesting little detail in these vestments. So going on with the rest of them, as the chapter progresses, the second part is this big robe that the high priest wears. And the real interesting part of it is that at the very bottom of this robe, on the hem of it, you have interspersed these golden bells that are making their their bell noise while the high priest is moving around, this jingling, this tinkling. And then you have these little objects that look like pomegranates. So this is the decorations on the bottom of the robe that the high priest is wearing. And it says here in verse 35, it shall be on Aaron, this robe, when he ministers, and its tinkling, that is the bells, the tinkling of the bells on the bottom of the robe, may be heard when he enters and leaves the holy place before the Lord, that he may not die. So evidently when the high priest was about to enter into the holy place, the most holy place, his movements would tinkle these bells. But this was kind of like when you don't just walk into the presence of the king, you're always announced. You know, to stroll in there and have a conversation with the king, you're announced, so the king knows you're coming, his area of power and authority. And these Jewish scholars relate this to the tinkling of the bells. It's, this is kind of the way of announcing to the King of Kings that the priest is about to enter into his presence. Maybe that's true, maybe it's not. We're really never told as to why these bells are on the bottom of the high priest's robe, but there they are. So moving next, we're gonna go from the bottom to the top. We have a I think this is fascinating. I mentioned this headband that the high priest is wearing. It's a plate of pure gold. This isn't like a bandana. This is a plate of gold that has these straps on it that can be attached, and this golden plate goes directly over the forehead of the high priest. And it's not just a golden plate, but it has engraved on it, "Holy to Yahweh, holy to the Lord." And it's fastened there on Aaron's forehead. Now, what I find amazing about this is that this is picked up later on in the book of Revelation. Let me find those references now. One is in Revelation chapter 14, verse 1. And there we read, I looked, this is Revelation 14, 1, I looked and behold, the Lamb was standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his name and the name of his father written on their foreheads. So this is picking up this image of the high priest in the Old Testament being holy to the Lord and having his name written on their forehead. This is echoed in chapter 22, verse 4, which I have here. This is describing the New Jerusalem. It says, "There shall no longer be any curse. The throne of God and the Lamb shall be in it, and his bondservants shall serve him. They shall see his face, and his name shall be on their foreheads." Now, what's fascinating about this, to me anyway, is that the high priest is the one who had "Holy to Yahweh" on his forehead in the Old Testament. And so in Revelation, you have every single believer, which is symbolically represented by this 144,000, every single believer elevated to this position of high priest because they have been united by baptism with that one who is the high priest, with Christ. So they are elevated to the position that the high priest held in the Old Testament. Remember, only he could go into the most holy place. And now every believer is invited into the most holy place because they're on the equal footing with the Old Testament high priest. And just as he had this golden plate on his forehead with "Holy to Yahweh" on there, so every believer has the name of Yahweh on their forehead by virtue of their connection with Christ.
Yeah, I mean that's
This is
yeah, I mean when you think about holy to the Lord or holy to Yahweh, this is what redemption is that God gives you his holiness, right? And makes you holy to himself. And so in baptism and in the atonement, you have this is sort of like all drawn out in the priesthood of all believers, right? That like all believers are priests to God, and all believers are holy to God, set apart by God, endowed with his holiness, his righteousness, sanctified by him. This is what enables us to all walk into the presence of God. And there's this cool thing that at least Lutherans talk this way, because of the language of baptism, where we say baptism is where God places his name on you, right? You're baptized in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. So you have the divine Trinitarian name placed on you in baptism. And that's where it never goes away. You sort of like you have the name of God like bestowed on you, and makes you holy. Pretty rad.
Yeah, it is. It is. I don't know why I can't get over the imagery of this divine name. I guess because the divine name in the Old Testament is everything. This is the divine revelation of who he is. And so to imagine every believer having Yahweh on their foreheads is amazing, is beautiful, is full of mystery. It's all of that wrapped into one, because that is God's way of claiming this person as their own, claiming each of us as his own, and sanctifying us, because there's nothing holier than the divine name. That's why we are to treat it, to sanctify it, to treat it as holy, because that name is a sacrosanct. And to have it placed upon our foreheads is to sanctify us, to fill us with the holiness that is God. So this is his way of claiming us as his own, permanently making us his own, and sanctifying us by putting that sacred name into the skin of our foreheads, and it's so that it's there indelibly. It's really beautiful. It's a beautiful sight.
You know, one of the things that's also interesting about that is that this might have nothing to do with it, but growing up in, you know, kind of broader evangelicalism, when you think about what do you think about typically? What does the typical Christian think about if they think about a name or something being placed on the forehead of somebody? Where typically people's minds go is like the mark of the beast or something, right?
Oh yeah, right. Yeah, right.
You know, like a name on your forehead has a very negative. Right? It's a very bad thing. And not so here, you know, like here you have the reverse of that. I mean, and of course it talks about the mark of the beast, and we're not going to get into that. But here you have God placing his name on your forehead. And this is, I think, you know, the forehead is an interesting place to put something, because you can't see it. I mean, if you have like a, you know, dirt on your forehead, you don't know it.
Right, right.
Someone has to tell you, or you have to look in a mirror, and you can't even see it. So it's not even, so I think there is something about God placing his name on you, and you can't see it, but it's so, but everyone else can. You're the only one who can't see it. But that doesn't mean that it's not true. It's actually super evident, like to the ones who are looking at it. And so it is sometimes, it feels like with the holiness of God, like I can't necessarily see it in my own, on my own person. I don't look that holy, but it's placed in such a way that it's not obvious to me, but it's also placed in the most obvious place. It's placed on my head, like at the very top of me.
But it's obvious to the one who put it there.
Yeah. The most obvious place you could possibly put it.
Yeah, yeah. Which is, I think, really the significance of this. This is all. And we have other language in the Old Testament about God seeing the rainbow and remembering his promise. So the rainbow wasn't so much given to Noah and to his descendants to remind them. God says, I'm putting the rainbow so that when I see it, I will remember my promise. So it's kind of like that with his name on our foreheads. God sees it there and he remembers. He acts in such a way that he continues to claim us as his own. So it's more for God to see and to affirm and to act on than it is for us.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's what the high priest had on his forehead every time he walked into the tabernacle to do his service. So that brings us pretty much to the end of this chapter. the last few verses talk about what not the high priest, but the regular priests were to wear. We covered that briefly last time. They have basically four different things that they wear, three of which are the same that the high priest wears. One thing that's different is the kind of headwear, a cap or something that they wear. But everything else is pretty much the same on those four items. And that's the way the chapter ends. So we'll get into the ordination chapter, which is what 29 is all about. Kind of walk you through this in the minutes we have remaining. We'll talk more about it next time. This is actually repeated in Leviticus 8 and 9, not word for word, but what happens or what is going to happen is described here. And then what actually happens, the actual ordination service. So what we're going to do in 29 is kind of give us a preview of what exactly is going to go down once it's time for Aaron and his sons to be ordained. This is an elaborate, very elaborate ceremony. This actually happens over the course of not a couple of hours, not even a couple of days. This is a 7-day ceremony. And we don't know if it's spread out over 7 days. It looks as if everything that happens on one day is to be repeated the next day. So it's like 7 days, they go through the same basic order of events. So that this is a lengthy and costly ceremony that takes place in order to set Aaron and his sons apart. So you have a sacrifice, you have bread and oil involved, you have, of course, blood involved, you have the vesting of the priest, all of this takes place. So I'll run rapidly through everything, just kind of summarizing everything that's gonna take place. So first of all, they get together everything they're going to need for the ordination itself. You're going to have two rams and a bull. So those are the animal sacrifices. And then you're going to have three types of unleavened bread. So you got one ram for one thing, another ram for another thing, a bull, and then you've got your bread. So you get those together, and then you get Aaron and his four sons, Eleazar and Ithamar and the other guys, get all of them together. You pull everything and everybody together at the doorway of the tent of meeting. And the first thing that takes place is that Aaron and his sons get a bath. Now, after this, every time that they are to serve at the tabernacle, they have to wash their hands and they wash their feet because they're stepping on sacred soil and they're handling sacred things. But at this point, they get washed with water. They get a bath. This is a cleansing that they go through at the very beginning of the ceremony. And then Aaron gets all of this stuff put on him that we've been talking about in chapter 28. So all of these various vestments get placed upon him. And then once they're on him, then he gets anointed. So this is in verse 7. It says, after all the vestments are on him, then the anointing oil is poured on his head. This is one of these instances in the Old Testament where you have a messianic kind of ceremony taking place. Messiah comes from the Hebrew word mashach, which means to anoint. So it's the same with Christ. Christ is the Greek form of that. If someone is christened, they are anointed. So if someone is mashached in the Old Testament, they are anointed. So the oil is poured on Aaron. This is how he is messiahed, or this is how he is anointed. This is a way in which people were set apart and placed into specific offices that God had created. And usually priests were anointed. You have some prophets who are said to be anointed, and you have kings who are anointed. That's that kind of language we're used to hearing as Christians about Christ as the prophet, priest, and king. These are the three main offices where people are anointed or messiahed in the Old Testament. So Aaron is anointed, and then same thing happens to his sons. They get vested, they get anointed. And then as the ceremony goes on, the first thing you have the sacrifice of the bull, and his blood's placed on the altar. Part of it's burnt on the altar, part of it's burnt outside the camp. Then you have the sacrifice of the first ram. That's a burnt offering, a whole burnt offering, which means that the whole animal is consumed on the altar. Then you have the sacrifice of the second ram, which is sometimes called the ram of the ordination, and its blood is placed on the altar. But one thing that's different about this ram is that part of his meat is given back to the priest so that they can consume it. So they end up consuming the very price of their atonement. So this takes place later in the ceremony.
Don't get me started. Then, don't get me started on that.
Yeah. And then, we'll come back to that for sure. And then one odd thing that takes place in this ceremony is that when the second ram is sacrificed, then part of the blood, once it's touched the altar and becomes sacred, part of the blood is placed on the earlobe of Aaron and his sons and their thumb. Part of the blood is placed on the thumb, and then part of the blood is placed on their big toe. And this is one of those situations where we really wish that God or Moses or someone would have spelled this out a little bit more for us as to why. The best explanation that I've heard is twofold. First of all, it's for purification. We have one more instance in the Old Testament where blood is placed on those three parts of the body, and it's for purification. But it also fits well with everything that the priest is to do, because his ear has blood placed upon it to sanctify it as the receptacle for hearing God's word. His hand has blood placed on it because he's handling holy things. And his toe has blood placed on it because he's going to be walking in on sacred ground, serving in the tabernacle. So this is the way in which those three parts of his body that are involved with hearing and acting on God's word are purified and sanctified. So then after all this takes place, then you have Aaron and his sons consuming the meat from the second sacrifice. And then everything happens again the next day, and then the next day, and then the next day, all through 7 days. So that, in a really quick run through, is what the whole worship service, if you will, the ordination service is all about. This is the way in which Aaron and his sons are, not just them, but actually them and their descendants are placed into this office. Because what's going to happen hereafter is that only Aaron's descendants, male descendants that meet certain qualifications, will serve as priest. So it's not like today when, you know, you don't have to be any kind of pedigree in order to serve as a pastor. But in the Old Testament, it's different. It was all genealogical. You had to be of the tribe of Levi, and you had to be the family of Aaron if you were to serve as a priest. And the high priesthood, the most authoritative office, was passed down from father to son, usually to the firstborn son. So this office of high priest then would be continued throughout the generations with a few discontinuities, but pretty much passed down from father to son throughout the generations. So I felt like I was kind of a rush through, but that kind of gives you the broad picture of what happens at the ordination service. So this, we'll have to unpack that a little bit more next time. But the main point that I want to make about this is that Aaron and his sons were set aside as priests. But even this elaborate service in which they were set aside points to their imperfection, points to the fact that something more was needed. And this is what the author of Hebrews tells us, that all of these Old Testament priests, no matter how good, no matter how holy, no matter how God-fearing they were incomplete, they were insufficient, because you did have to have sacrifices offered for them, and they would eventually die. They were sinners. They were in need of another priest to come along, and that's what we have in Christ, our high priest, who comes to fulfill the office that they imperfectly filled throughout the Old Testament.
Yeah, it turns out that God just works through damaged goods because he doesn't have any other options.
It's his only option. Yeah, he's got imperfect, sinful people. That's what he works with still today.
Yep, that's all there is, man. And that's all the time there is. So, guys, we want you to come hang out with us, record the podcast live with us. It's going to be a great time. Come out to San Diego, herewestillstand.org. Also, if you want to help us out, a good way to do that, an easy, good, free way to do that, help us out. If you like this podcast, is to go to our iTunes and rate and review it. That gives it more visibility. So if you go over there, drop a rating, of course, a 5-star rating, of course, is the one that you drop. And then just a sentence. I mean, just a line or two, on a review. That stuff helps us out. So they take note of that sort of thing and then kind of push it in their recommended podcasts and things like that. So that would help us out. If you haven't done that and you like the podcast, that's a good way to hook us up. Well, Chad, that's it for this week, man. We'll see you next week. Thanks, bud.
All right, man. Thank you. We'll see you then.